Okay. Well, thanks, Kathy. And the fortunate part was is that Kathy was nice enough to get her slides done in time for me to look at them before I did mine. So I threw out 80% of my talk that she had already covered. So hopefully I won't bore you too much by essentially saying the same thing over and over and over again. So I'm going to talk a little bit today, and I'm going to take a little bit of a broader view. I'm going to take the view of the poor physicist who either A, has their physician come in and say, I just saw this great thing. How soon can we put it in? And I'm going to sit there going, what is it? What do I do with it? Or perhaps it's even me going, hey, physician, I just saw this thing, and I don't have to deal with the NRC and radioactive materials. I would really like to do that. And so either way, you can imagine the scenario within the people that you work with as to what could happen that way. And so I'm going to try to talk a little bit about how I might approach this if it came to me one way or the other, and some of the tools that might be available to me as a physicist in the clinic to be able to look at this problem and see what we can do about it. But I should tell you a little bit about me to start with so you understand where I'm coming from. I was not trained by going through an educational program, but I did it with mostly on-the-job training. I started off, in fact, as a person who wrote treatment planning software for a radiation clinic, and the physicist there decided that I might be useful to something other than writing software, so he had me helping him with weekly and monthly QA and doing going to the residence courses, so I learned a little bit of physics and clinic, and so I did that. Whoops, and I hit the wrong button. Well, let's try this again. Okay, phew. I do have a degree in physics. I also have one in engineering, and then I foolishly went back and got one in computer science, too. I was having more fun being in school than other things, so I decided to keep doing that. I also have this experience that starts off in New Hampshire, where I was a programmer and a service engineer. I then spent a lot of years in Massachusetts in an academic medical center, and somewhere along there, they decided I ought to be laser safety officer because radiation oncology departments use lasers to set up patients, so I must be the person who could do a laser safety program. Well, many of you know that lasers in the OR are a lot different, but I did that anyway. I then took a break from the academic world and went to work for a company just outside of Pittsburgh where I was nominally the RSO, but that's because we had some service people who needed to be film badged, so there had to be someone who kept track of it. I won't tell you that I was an RSNO in the traditional sense of the word. And then about 4 years ago, I went to the University of Michigan, where I'm now back in the academic world and am head of the clinical physics group there. So most of my training is not formal medical physics. I've had one or two courses sort of on the side, but most of it's been picked up by going to meetings, listening to talks, and doing a lot of reading. So I come from that kind of a background. But I will not claim that I'm a simple country physicist. Those of you who come from the Mid-Atlantic and Southeast chapters will roughly know where that quote comes from. That's from my friend George Shirouse, who was the inventor, if you will, of virtual simulation, a computer method for using CT to do treatment planning. But he now calls himself a simple country physicist, and I won't take that claim. I've been involved with technology for a long time. And continue to use it quite a bit. But medical physicists today have a very different background. I don't think on-the-job training is really allowable today. It just doesn't happen. The field's gotten too complex, too advanced, and in essence, there's too much technology to learn to do it on the job well. That doesn't say that they don't have some form of a master's degree or a PhD. It may be in radiation treatment, it may be in medical physics, or it may be general physics or engineering. But if they come out of a general physics or an engineering point of view, they quite often will have to have some additional training. Some academic centers offer postdoctoral training that has a clinical component. And I'll say clinical in quotes, because some of them you get to watch one or two times a week. And some of them you actually do get to do some work. And of course, medical physics residencies are now becoming common, where you actually have a 2-year training period, quite similar to the medical residencies that our radiation oncologists do. And we're trying to promote that, but they're not enough today to train the people that we need, although there's an indication that, for example, the American Board of Radiology is going to require such a training by around 2012. So AAPM, among others, is working very hard to try to improve the number of residencies so that people will come out with some base level of minimal clinical training in order to do their job, and that will help all of us, I believe. But the truth is that medical physicists today, coming out of whatever program they have, I will guess that more than 50% of them today have not worked in an academic department before they took their first job. Many of them are masters. I think believe that we now know that 50% or more of the members of AAPM have a master's degree only, whereas 30 years ago it was predominantly PhDs in the field. So there's been a great change towards, if you will, a clinical service component as opposed to an academic research component in the field. And many of the people who come out of a training, a master's in medical physics or a PhD program, may in fact have never set foot in a clinic when they took their first job. My friend George Shrouse, who I mentioned earlier, actually interviewed some people who were graduating from a master's program from an institution that I won't name. But in fact, he showed his prospective applicant a chart, and it was clear from his interviewing of the applicant that the applicant had never seen a patient chart before. And this person wanted to go to work for George, who runs a consulting business where they were in direct patient consultation. And George just said, you know, you need to go find a residency program somewhere. You're not suitable to work for me. But the fact that there's such a shortage of medical physicists mean that people are essentially trying to jumpstart. They don't necessarily want to spend 2 years in a residency position, which is not, it's not bad paying, but it's certainly not the payment you can get as a medical physicist. And so they are essentially trying to jumpstart that process. And it's an issue. It's an issue that we take very seriously, but we don't necessarily have the right training. In addition, even some of the medical residency, the medical physics residency programs don't provide a complete spectrum of training. If the institution doesn't do a lot of brachytherapy, you may not have a lot of brachytherapy as a medical physicist coming out of that training. They don't do radiosurgery or image-guided radiotherapy. You may not get the exposure that allows you to practice independently when you finish your residency program or training program. And so they are working again now to figure out how to make residency programs that are incomplete, how to allow these people to get this training. But it is certainly an issue. And then, of course, you have new technology coming across, and you sit there and look, and somebody comes up and says, well, here's electronic brachytherapy. And I, even with my training on the job, I'm not sure that even 10 years ago I might have felt comfortable with putting this new technology in the clinic just off the cuff, because I don't have training in it. And so how do I get that education? How do I get that experience? I've had enough experience and had my hands burned enough times that I tend to be pretty safe about what I'm doing and pretty careful about it. But a lot of new physicists may jump right in. And what we really don't want to happen is for someone to jump right in and make some foolish mistakes that are avoidable and essentially put a bad name to a technology that can be do a lot of good. I was in the forefront of IMRT, intensity modulated radiation therapy, and that was one of our biggest concerns, that somebody would say, look at all the money I can make from IMRT. I'm just going to start using it. And they would make a mistake, and patients would get undertreated or mistreated, and we would have that problem. So that's a real concern that all of us share, both the profession, you as regulators, and anyone else, the physicians as well. So if I'm a physicist today, how do I learn about regulations and regulators? How do I find out what's going on? Well, the truth is most people find out first because they're given a film badge. And the film badge has a little bit of training associated with it. You have to do that. Eventually, in your film badge, you have to take an annual radiation safety training course. Our institution is no different from anyone else, and you learn a bunch of information about radiation safety. So first exposure to just pretty much what radiation means in what you're doing. Of course, there are textbooks. I mentioned before that I read a bunch of them. And as part of a training program, hopefully they would expose you to one or two of these. A major source of information is local chapter meetings. These are students. These are junior physicists. They're not going to get to AAPM or other of the big meetings. They're the people who get left behind. But you'll notice this is from the local chapter of the Great Lakes Society. And here's Cheryl Schultz, one of our physicists who's been active in our chapter, who's giving a talk on Michigan's prospect for becoming an NRC agreement state. That's a mechanism we're in the process of starting to walk through. But in addition, we had members of the regulatory groups within Michigan, MDCH, Consumer Health, and Community Health, and the Department of Environmental Quality, who came to our meeting and essentially participated in a panel following the meeting to talk to us about what was going on in the state, where they were going. And these are tremendously valuable forums for our members and our junior members and students in particular to learn about what's going on. AAPM has a virtual library. This talk is becoming part of the virtual library. So AAPM has a mechanism where we can allow people who can't get to our annual meeting to be able to listen to talks, look into the slides, and be able to essentially get some of the training that they couldn't get because they were too junior on the list to make it to the meeting. And that's also very good. You can read the regulations. This sounds rash, but some of us actually have read the wonderful regulations. It's amazingly convenient now that they're on the web, and so you can go pick them up and read them. I'm sure you've all had to read at least some of them. They are not necessarily the world's most stunning material to read. They are very good bedtime reading for many people. And of course, there's the web. Right now, we see huge patient demand from patients who are reading the web to find out where to be treated. And so if you type in radiation regulations brachytherapy, amazingly enough, the CRCPD comes up, came up first, as a matter of fact. Now, it took me about five different cases before I found one where you did. But that was pretty good. And interestingly enough, one of my medical physics residents, when I mentioned that I was going to the CRCPD, he said, oh, yes, that's the group that does the suggested state regulations. Now, I'll tell you that I didn't know that. And I can't tell you how long I was in the profession before I knew of the existence of CRCPD and the suggested state regulations. So the fact that you have a web presence and it comes up if somebody's looking at some information is a tremendously valuable asset to your organization to bringing you into the milieu of what students are looking at and how people are learning about it. Because it didn't come up in my training, I think, until Massachusetts started to go through the agreement state process. And so the suggested state regulations came up as a starting point for their regulations. I didn't know about it before then. Okay, who are the regulators today perceived by medical physicists? All right, you have the answers in front of you, so I can't ask you this as a blanket question. Clearly, the NRC is the group that we're most familiar with. We're most familiar with it because it's in textbooks. We hear about it. Almost every training program goes through it. Even if you don't have radioactive materials at your site, you learn about the NRC. It's very consistent. We also, in the last few years, have learned about the Department of Transportation with regard to the NRC, because all of a sudden there were these rules on who was a shipper of radioactive materials. And for many small clinics, suddenly the medical physicist had to become an approved DOT shipper in order to receive and send out radioactive prostate seeds, HDR sources. This terrified everyone. And AAPM, several years ago, had a FedEx lecturer come in and essentially give a four-hour training course, if I remember right, on DOT regulations that you could pass to get your certification or at least show you had the correct training, and we had standing room only in that course. It was a tremendous threat, and so this whole idea of having to ship radioactive materials is a real issue to a lot of the small clinics that exist today. Now, the good news is that many of the manufacturers have stepped up, and they now essentially ship on behalf of the site. Their own manufacturer's representative comes in and does the packaging and shipping, so that essentially it's Company X who supplies the HDR material who's essentially shipping it at both ends. But I think there's still this fear from many individuals that this is a problem. State regulators, we know about you because you take care of our x-ray tubes and we have to pay you some amount of money each year every time we get one. So we know all about that. We typically, the state regulators have for years handled the NARM and the cyclotron radionuclides. That, of course, is about to change for some of you, for us as well. But we do know about you because of that. Strangely enough, we consider practice accreditation agencies as regulators. They have a lot to do with how we practice. So the Joint Commission, or the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals, or the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, whichever name you want to call it. Today they're just the Joint Commission. But they come in every few years and they wander through the hospital for 5 days, maybe even 2 weeks, and let me tell you, everybody jumps when that they come in. Why do they do that? Because they control how we get reimbursed. So the hospital pays a lot of attention to that. ACR and the ACRO are two professional groups, and they accredit radiation oncology practices. And so they come in, and if you subscribe to one of their accreditations, they come in and they look at your procedures, they look at your documentation, they look at your staffing, and they decide whether you have adequate staffing for what you do. So they, again, are groups that are very important. There are, of course, billing that's always important, so we look at what happens with CMS. And CMS now is doing inspections of hospitals. We actually have a CMS inspector in our hospital probably once every other month. They come in for a day or two they walk some process through. And I'll tell you that right at the moment, they are the most frequent inspector that we see in our institution. JC, Joint Commission, comes in every 3 years. In our case, the state inspectors come in once a year, but they only inspect each area every 5 years. So essentially, I only see a state inspector once every 5 years in my practice in general. And of course, AMA comes in because of CPT and billing codes, and occasionally the FDA because we might look at some experimental therapy. I would say for most physicists, however, who don't work in a clinic that has academic and perhaps research information, they don't pay much attention to the FDA. The FDA is really something that academic centers and centers who are doing IRBs, they pay a lot of attention to, but physicists and most physicists today don't have to pay much attention to them. Then there are what I'll call the other regulators. These are the groups that put out guidances that happen, or in our case, they also have certification boards. So I pay a lot of attention to what happens with the ABR, and ABHP, or ABM, MP, because they are people who are going to essentially worry about how I can practice. So the fact that all medical physics certifications became time limited in 2002 is important, because those people certified after then now have to get credits, they have to go through information, or they'll lose their certification. And that's important, so people pay attention to that. There are the guidance groups. I don't know of any physicist who doesn't have a copy of an NCRP publication on shielding sitting on their shelves. I probably have three of them because I collect them, because people keep borrowing them and taking them away. But they are tremendously important, because even though the state rules for shielding may be different, pretty much everyone says if you do it the NCRP way, you are going to be okay. And so most of us shield at least in principle based on what the NCRP tells us to do. And that's the textbook we have to worry about. And today, as I said, the web presence is out there. CRCPD is there. So I start looking at suggested state regulations. And so I have looked at them for a number of years, and people are beginning to become more aware of you and your work. And so that's a good thing as well. There are also references out there. AAPM publishes reports. These are not reports typically on cutting-edge, bleeding-edge technology, as Keith said yesterday. These are essentially reports on state of practice. So there will be reports there on things like, what's the right way to do a radiosurgery program? What's the right way to calibrate your brachytherapy sources? These are reports that try to essentially codify standard practice in a way that physicists can look at. Some of these reports are available only to medical to members of AAPM, but there are a few of them that they've deemed important enough that they've made them available to the community at large. Okay, so that's who physicists are. That's what we do. You guys mostly knew that already. But now let's go look at this thing that I have, new technology. And so I want to know, what do I do with this new technology? So traditionally, new technology started in the academic centers. And to the credit of Zoft, they've essentially been working predominantly with academic centers, or I'll say academically oriented clinical centers, but people who are willing to sit down and think about what happens. And the academic centers would do worry about safety. They'd worry about efficacy. They'd do some sort of a trial to make sure it was reasonable. And they'd probably come out with a publication or a refresher course at a meeting or something that would allow that to happen. And so if before it went to the clinic in, you know, downtown Spokane, it was vetted, if you will, by some academic group. That's not true today. First thing off is patient demand. Somebody publishes a report about electronic brachytherapy. It gets on the web, and all of a sudden, patients are demanding it. And I've talked recently because of protons, so there's proton beams coming in, and some huge amount of the proton patients coming to be treated with protons are actually self-referred. They've heard about protons. They don't know whether they need it or not, but they've decided they want it. And they go to an institution that does it. So if you have a proton beam, you suddenly get these referrals from patients who perhaps you didn't really need to treat with protons. There was equivalently good technology, but that's not what the patient wanted. The patient wanted proton beams. And so that is what's happening. And there's a whole thing with prostate brachytherapy. When Andy Grove of Intel blogged, it wasn't called a blog then, but he wrote something out on the web about how wonderful permanent prostate brachytherapy was, and all of a sudden there was this huge explosion in permanent prostate brachytherapy. So as these things get out and some patient finds out about them, it becomes very common that clinical centers suddenly say, we've got to have it. Because patients are saying, if you don't have it, I'm going somewhere else. And of course, there's Google. And so if you can go in and you can put in, you know, electronic brachytherapy into Google, and guess what? Something comes out with news on electronic brachytherapy. So somebody issues a press release, it gets out there, patients start saying, I'm going to get brachytherapy? What is it? They go Google it and they find out. All right, what is electronic brachytherapy? How many people here watched the first generation of Saturday Night Live? Okay, so some people know what the floor wax dessert topping discussion is. All right, Saturday Night Live does take off on certs. Two breast mints in one. So there was new shimmer, the dessert topping / floor wax. And so you can ask, brachytherapy, is it a floor wax? Is it a dessert topping? Is it both? All right? And this is just the thing. Over here on one side, we have essentially the Zoft system. You've seen this information already. Over here is Mammocyte. They look pretty much the same to me. I'm not sure I could tell which one is which. Here's some dose distributions. This is dose distributions from the iridium 192. You get sort of this double-lobed thing, and Kathy's already very nicely talked about doing pullbacks in a catheter. So, okay, that's what that looks like. Iridium 192 brachytherapy. It does require an NRC license, as I said, may require DOT training. And Kathy's been through kind of these things that are issues that maybe people have with using iridium 192. She didn't really say it very loudly, but it was pretty clear that when you're treating with electronic brachytherapy, you're typically in the room with a patient. And so if you're in the room with a patient, the need for an audio system and a video system and all this monitoring goes away. So it becomes a much simpler treatment, and there are many things you don't have to worry about. 50 kVb brachytherapy, well, yeah, kind of looks like a double-lobed treatment. You've got clearly where you can have devices and pullbacks. It looks pretty much the same. And so this is an interesting thing. So here we have an X-ray technology that Kathy's described very well, but this X-ray technology looks like brachytherapy. And so the question is, I'm the physicist, it's coming to me, what do I do with it? Is it an X-ray source? Is it a brachytherapy source? How do I calibrate it? How do I do it safely? What are the procedures I need to put in place to make it work? Well, it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck. It looks like a brachytherapy source. It acts like a brachytherapy source. As Kathy noted briefly, you use a brachytherapy planning system to calculate its dose. So you actually treat it like a brachytherapy source. It may even be better than a brachytherapy source. Here's some graphs that show, here's the some various sources. So up here in green is the iridium-192, essentially, if you will, a death dose, if you will. The dose is a function of distance over a few cm. And what you'll notice is that the 50 kV is way down in here somewhere. So in fact, it's falling off quicker than my iridium-192 source that I'm using in my mammocyte or my HDR treatment, which means that I can shield it more easily. I can localize it, so it's even more brachy than brachytherapy as we know it today. Well, that seems like a pretty good thing to me. How do I calibrate it? Well, I calibrate it in a well chamber. When I calibrate it in a well, what do I calibrate in a well chamber now? Well, I calibrate brachytherapy sources. So this seems to me like it's, again, it looks and feels like a brachytherapy system to me. So I'm going to be probably approaching it as if it were a brachytherapy system in terms of the way I want to operate it. This is one of the things, benefits of traveling around here and there, is I happened to be in Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago. And while I was in Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago, I happened to ask Bruce Tomodson, who many of you may know, and I asked Bruce about what was going to talk to him about the suggested state regulations and electronic brachytherapy. And he said, well, you know, we have a PhD student who's giving his presentation on his thesis on Monday. Why don't you come hear him? And so I happened to catch Stephen Davis from Wisconsin essentially doing his presentation on how you calibrate one of these sources. How do you figure out how to use it? And he essentially has done some Monte Carlo modeling of the source so that we can essentially model it and he can see what it looks like. And when he does that, you get a polar anisotropy function. And if any of you have seen TG43, the way you calibrate the procedure process for calculating brachytherapy sources, this is a function in a brachytherapy source calibration. There's also a radial dose function, and he just shows here that what he measures and what he calculates with MCNP pretty much looks the same. So what we're really saying here is that you can model this using the TG43 formalism, and it will essentially look just like, and it will calculate just like an iridium-192 source. Obviously, the constants and the numbers are a little different, but it essentially looks pretty much exactly like what we're trying to use here. So, we have a device that provides a brachytherapy-like treatment. Actually, it's not brachytherapy-like at all. It is brachytherapy treatment. But it doesn't use radioactive materials, so that means I have a certain amount of licensing headache and documentation and paperwork I might be able to minimize. As Kathy showed earlier, we have several studies that the device is safe, effective, and it can be used in a clinic with proper training. The device can be modeled as if it was a brachytherapy source, and treatments are planned on a brachytherapy planning system. And we have a method for calibration of these sources so that we're confident of the daily dose to be delivered. How do I explain this device to my state regulators if I'm the physicist in, what's a state Kathy didn't mention? Arizona. All right, so I'm in Arizona, or I'm in Michigan. She didn't mention Michigan. Okay, so I'm in Michigan, and I say, I would like to get one of these. And so I go to my state regulators, and they go, well, sure, put your ion chamber in air and measure your X-ray source, you know, at 10 centimeters distance, because that's the way you measure radiation sources, X-ray tubes, and we'll get a calibration, and you'll show wait a minute. It doesn't work that way. And so how do we get regulations that are going to make sense in this? I'm trying to give you a good lead-in, Kim. So, as you might have guessed, and you've heard about this briefly, the AAPM has been working on some essentially proposed additions or modifications to the suggested state regulations that could be used to try to make electronic brachytherapy fit in with the rest of the world and what we do. And so there's a new suggestion that in X.2 that you add some information about what electronic brachytherapy is. There's a whole bunch of stuff on source calibrations. I put this in here. I don't really expect you to read this. It's in your notes so you know what's kind of going on. But in fact, if you look at it, you'll find that it's modeled very closely on the HDR regulations of NRC 35.6XX or the suggested state regulations documentation. So it's going to be functionally, it's going to look like and operate like an HDR iridium 192 treatment. So if you're familiar with an iridium 192 treatment, we've tried to make it look very much the same way in terms of what they've done here. There's an authorized medical physicist who does calibrations. They do spot checks. That looks, again, just like what a medical physicist does. And there are a whole bunch of rules of things, and Kathy alluded to this already, that there are essentially inspection of the treatment components. There's inspection of the transfer tubes and all this information. It's just like a brachytherapy source. So that in terms of the way you would approach this, we've tried to come forth with a model that you can look at and adopt that would essentially allow you to look at it this way. And Kim will speak a lot more about this, so I don't want to say too much more about it here. Treatment planning computers, also, same regulations as for iridium 192 brachytherapy. Same, essentially, I could look at that and I couldn't tell you in principle whether it was coming from, this is where I get really bad, whether it was coming from 35.7657 or whether it's coming from suggested state regulations. It looks pretty much like the same text and the same rules I have to apply. So as a physicist, I can look at it and go, oh, this makes sense to me. I know what I need to do here. These are rules that I'm used to. I've worked with before. I have a process that fits in. And so if this all works out, it's something that clinically I have some handle on how to make it work in my clinic. So that's a good thing for me. Now, the fortunate part is that I'm not alone in my clinic. There are lots of resources out there. And so AAPM has these are just some slides, in fact, from the upcoming AAPM meeting in Minneapolis at the end of July, where there's professional symposiums essentially that talk about practice quality improvement and clinical procedures and training of the future, how to minimize errors. So there's a professional program that this would be material that would be part of, that we would essentially, AAPM would have people giving training courses for people on this. There's also therapy and imaging symposiums, you know, since protons are big right now. So right now AAPM has this information. But you can imagine that if electronic brachytherapy moves on, that there'll be the good and not so good of electronic brachytherapy will probably be the next year's symposium that will come up from someone who will want to present it. There's also continuing education. So you could obviously hear imaging and for assessment and new technologies. So there are courses that are evolved to allow the medical physicist and those who attend to get the training they need. So AAPM essentially is helping to train physicists to be able to use this new technology. There are summer schools. In fact, I first learned about one of the early exposures I had to Zoft was at the brachytherapy physics school in 2005, because they brought a system in there to educate some of the brachytherapy physicists about this alternative that wasn't quite ready for prime time at that moment, but at least we got a sort of feel for what it was there. Interestingly enough, that most of us found out about it again in a brachytherapy summer school that was focused on radioactive materials. In fact, I don't think there was any other mention of X-ray devices in that summer school except for this device. AAPM this summer is doing one on shielding and the new shielding formalisms. And that woman over there named Melissa has an awful lot to do with that particular summer school, foolish woman that she is. She can't find too many. I don't know how she ever gets her work done. because she seems to be running this symposium and that symposium, and she's at this meeting and that meeting. I think that the people who work for her must be crazy. I've already mentioned that ACR has enormous amount of standards, so they put together practice standards for guidelines for radiation oncology. So you can imagine that the ACR will be working to modify their practice diagram for high-dose rate brachytherapy, which is at this point completely iridium-192 based, that I would hope that they would be thinking, well, we better start looking at how to modify this standard to include electronic brachytherapy in it and give some guideline as to how practices should use this technology, what kind of training needs to be involved. I mentioned accreditation programs. Radiation ACR is one of the sites that has this accreditation program, where, again, they look at program goals, they look at staffing, they look at, do you have the right processes and procedures in place to do this safely and effectively? And finally, there's the virtual library. And so I told Kathy your picture was in my presentation, and I happened to look, and AAPM has started these manufacturer forums where a manufacturer can come up and essentially apply to AAPM to record a session discussing new technology. And so it just happens that in 2006, that Kathy got up and gave a presentation along with some other people about this new technology and how it might be used in the clinic. So there are educational sessions that I can go out on the web, and I could, you know, if the wireless network were good enough in this hotel, I could probably go out and listen to it now. Fortunately, unfortunately, it's not. So I would like to thank a bunch of people who I stole slides, information from. Stephen Davis, as I noted, I put the PhD after his name. I think he's gotten it by now. He was close. Bruce Tomatson, who has been part of the AAPM group, who's been working on with others to suggest, put together the proposed regulations for electronic brachytherapy. Kathy O'Shaughnessy, who gave me some slides. And in case you wondered, my New Yorker cartoons came from New Yorker Complete Book of Cartoons, which is a wonderful book if you're a New Yorker cartoon fan. But most importantly, they give you two DVDs with every cartoon they've ever put in place there. So that I hope I haven't been too bad for you for this morning. And what we've arranged to do is to essentially give you an extended break. So instead of a half hour, an hour for the break, so that people will have a chance to be able to go over and look at the equipment. And then after the break, Kim will come back and tell you about how to regulate it. So thank you very much. And we'll take lots of questions now, or we can either wandering around. Yes? Good. Good to see you. By the way, this man and I actually had to run in the middle of the pouring rain in Boston in 1995 as the local arrangements chairman.
Who won that race anyway?
Not us.
Am I on?
You're on.
Okay. Thanks, Bruce. Quick, couple points. This is fascinating technology. In fact, I think I saw something like this back probably over 10 years ago in medical physics, these very small X-ray sources.
Yeah.
I think it was up in some firm up in Boston that it's got to be 1990.
Thunderstick, I think, was its initial name.
And it looked, in fact, I think I copied the article. It looked like it had great potential back then. And I commend, you know, the commercialization of this. A couple of quick things. On the operator, you know, the 15 milliram per hour caught my eye. I think that's probably easily dealt with some portable, you know, shielding, leaded plexiglass or leaded glass in the room. You wouldn't want an operator sitting in that kind of field, depending on your workload.
No, I don't believe it's envisioned to be that way.
Yeah, the calibration though concerns me. In the point that these tubes are disposable, and the reproducibility of that, I'm not sure the physics of the tube or the continuous, you know, constant potential pulse. Would you envision a pre-calibration in a well chamber? Is that going to be bolus? Is there going to be air in the chamber? These are all the kind of issues that are going to be swirling through everybody's heads as they try to get their arms around this. Because I'm sure in our regulations in Pennsylvania, we're looking at this. We see it coming down the road, and you know, our regulations aren't adequate to address these, so we're going to have to do something sort of out of the box.
Do you want me to address the calibration one
first? Well, I'll just state that the nice thing is when you go over and look at the unit, you'll notice the well chamber on it that's actually used day-to-day as part of the calibration just exactly for that.
The calibration was one of the areas that obviously the FDA also had a lot of back and forth with us on. So the way we stand right now is we use a standard imaging air ionization well chamber. It's built into the system. We've coupled that with a standard imaging electrometer. Those are initially calibrated by the manufacturer, by Zoft, and then the physicist at the site would need to get those recalibrated every 2 years. The calibration we use is an interim calibration. We don't have a standard that NIST has developed. It turns out that the combination of our low energy and high dose rate means that they have to think a little bit harder about the calibration methodologies they currently use. So what Steve Davis's thesis was about was working with the group at University of Wisconsin to develop an interim standard. So what they basically made a lot of measurements of our source in a well chamber concurrently with our source in a free air chamber. And so that translation of the value you get in a well chamber, so if you measure 90 nanoamps in a well chamber, how do you convert that to an air Kirmes strength is using this interim standard. And so that's described in our operator manual, and they've also published a technical note from University of Wisconsin MRRC about it. So I agree, the calibration is a really important thing. So that's the method. The second question you asked was, how often do you have to do it? What's the reproducibility? The reason we built a calibration prior to each fraction into the treatment system, that was a couple years ago, is just to preclude any potential changing of the source. From a hazard point of view, it just seems simpler. We'll measure it right before you treat the patient, therefore you know what the output's going to be. We have fairly strict quality measures internally. We measure and qualify every source before it gets used. And so we have certain requirements that the fraction-to-fraction stability of the source has to be a certain percentage. It's less than 2%. So we've put bounds on it. And then as Bruce said, in the recommendations for the guidelines, the spot checks and the calibration are one of the areas I think that are translating most easily from the HDR, except of course you don't measure your iridium source prior to each fraction. You measure and calibrate the output, and then you're using the exponential decay. So it's that difference. You've got an X-ray source that potentially could be different every time you turn it on, and how are you controlling that? And I agree, that's one of the main questions we get.
And I would say that I didn't bring out Steve's thesis presentation, which I have the slides with 47 pages of equations on them, but he's done a very nice job, and they believe that they can consistently get a better than 2% calibration on these sources under multiple exposures. So I think he's got that in. I'm not free to share his slides, unfortunately, but I believe it's in publication, and so he's got a very excellent procedure where he shows that these devices are reproducible over the course of their 10 or 12 uses. And quite consistent, and that this is just sort of icing on the cake.
Well, talk about a loaded question. The question is training. Zoft offers training to the whole team. The physicist tends to take the brunt of that. They're the sort of, we found that they're the focal point in the clinic for really understanding the technology. The training for the surgeon is in two areas. One is creation of a lumpectomy cavity that's conducive to balloon brachytherapy. You want to have a cavity that has a chance that isn't too irregularly shaped, so you get good conformance of the tissue. And then again, if the surgeon is the one that's going to implant the applicator, then we do training on that as well. I have to say, our early experiences with people who already are very experienced with balloon brachytherapy, so the we've developed modules for the brand new user, but it hasn't been as tried out as our current modules right now. And so far, the results have been very good. They don't tend to want to devote a lot of time, but I think we're able to effectively get the appropriate training. I should mention, I presented, the applicator will tend to be placed by the surgeon, but there are sites where the radiation oncologist, if they're very interventionally oriented, do the applicator placement. And I have one site actually in Seattle. In fact, I think Dr. Parikh is one of the speakers here. I thought I saw him on the list. He actually is a radiologist that places the balloon applicator. So the placement of the applicator, I think maybe it comes down to your question, who's familiar with using ultrasound and has that capability, that tends to be who it's done by.